If you do not have a validated tap card, you may be subject to penalties.
It's not Compton, what's up, punk? It's South Central, a crime wave of gangster made criminals.
South Central Los Angeles, in mainstream media and in the minds of those who don't work or live here, is often branded by the violent and chaotic flashpoints in its history.
South Central Rooted will demonstrate that these events were culminations of the generations of institutional neglect and exploitation that precedes them. Although some of the conditions changed, this legacy still affects South LA residents in all aspects of their daily lives, from housing and employment to transportation, policing, and the environment.
Yeah, we don't want to do anything to scare your children. That's the last thing we want to do.
Welcome, and thank you for joining us for this episode of South Central Rooted. Before we begin, I am inviting us to take a moment to honor the life of George Floyd. We are recording this episode on April 21. Yesterday, a jury found former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin guilty on all counts for the murder of George Floyd. And we celebrate the verdict today. We also recognize that it feels new and unreal because it is so rare to see a member of our community get justice after losing their lives at the hands of law enforcement. It does not escape us that this decision did not come easily, though. Millions of people across the world took to the streets to demand an end to the senseless killings of Black people by the police. And we know we need to shift funding away from law enforcement, away from incarceration, and towards programs for young people. We need more quality, affordable housing, jobs that pay meaningful, livable wages, more childcare, more mental health support, and a stronger social safety net all around. We also need legislation that corrects history and holds the unjust system of incarceration and policing in the United States accountable for abusing their power. We need a system that ends racial and religious profiling. It ends qualified immunity and, more importantly, protects our more vulnerable communities. Today's session will touch on how we move towards dismantling systems that, like policing, have prevented Black residents and other people of color from accessing the full benefits that society has to offer. My name is Elmer Roldan, and I am one of your hosts for the podcast, South Central Rooted. We have put together a great show for you today. I'm very excited about our conversation. It will focus on drivers of disparity, poverty, disinvestment, and joblessness. So it's a pretty thick one that we're going to lay on you today. We will examine the many ways in which concentrated poverty in South Central LA continues to be shaped by a legacy of racial, residential segregation, and disinvestment. Black and brown residents in South LA suffer from high rates of unemployment and poverty. Employment is often limited to low wages, non-standard work agreements, and we know that this all results in the growing income inequality. I live on Slauson and Broadway. Street vendors are a big source of the economy where I live. People are surviving by selling food or used items on the streets. That has become the norm all around me. And we know that poverty is more than just an individual or a family phenomenon that's isolated from the environment. People living in areas of concentrated poverty like South Central LA means they have access to less opportunities to get out of poverty. So we're gonna go ahead and get started. As much as I love to hear myself talk, we're here today to hear my colleagues and social justice heroes that we have invited here today. We have three real OGs in the community join our panel discussion. I'm very excited to welcome these leaders. Today, I'm gonna start by inviting and bowing down to the very special Ms. Barbara Lott Holland to join us. And please say hello and tell us a few words about the work that you do at the Strategy Center and briefly explain your organization's mission. Barbara, please.
Hello, everyone. Again, this is Barbara Lott Holland, Associate Director at the Labor Community Strategy Center. And the goal and our main strategic plan is a Black and Brown United Front to fight imperialism in the United States, with an emphasis and in joining with the Third World.
All right, next we have Benjamin Torres, better known in the social justice world as Mr. Benny Torres. Benny, please say hello to our audience members and tell us about your role at CD Tech.
As you said, my name is Benny Torres. I'm the president and CEO of CD Tech, an organization that was founded by Dr. Denise Fairchild with an interest in dealing with race equity and economic justice issues in South Los Angeles pertaining to Black, Brown, and immigrant residents. Our goal is to build power, create economic opportunity that's driven by the existing members and understanding the social historic legacy created by Black folks in South Central Los Angeles so that we can have a healthy and good quality of life for its existing residents.
And now we're going to welcome Janelle Bailey. If you could please say hello to our audience and tell us about what you do at the Los Angeles Black Workers Center.
Hello, everybody. I'm Janelle Bailey. I am one of two co-executive directors at the Los Angeles Black Workers Center. And it's good to see everybody. I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me. At the BWC, the Black Workers Center, we envision an equitable economy in which Black workers thrive and build vibrant families and communities. Our mission is to address discrimination, improve job access, and remove barriers for Black workers, improving the industries that employ us. And we do that through action and unionization. So yeah, I'm excited to be here with everyone.
Great. Okay, so we want to start this conversation by putting into context the economic disparities that many residents in South LA experience. In the 50s and 60s, labor shortages and heavy manufacturing and an executive order banning racial discrimination in the public sector and federal contracts especially paved the way for a growing Black middle class in South LA. A lot of people don't realize that there was a time when South LA was a thriving community, especially for Black families. Unfortunately, there was a sharp economic shift with deindustrialization and factories leaving during the 70s that were primarily driven by white flight, urban neglect, disinvestment, and other factors that trap Black people in poverty, in what is now a very common image that we see on television and in movies. Today, South Los Angeles residents fare worse in almost all economic indicators compared to the rest of LA County, which includes poverty rates, the median income, per capita income, unemployment, home ownership, I mean, you name it. As a result, South LA residents historically lack economic mobility. So what I want to do is I want to jump right into the conversation. I'd love to start with Janelle. If you can tell us about some of the main factors that have contributed to the legacy of economic discrimination against the Black community, particularly in South Los Angeles.
You know, we've termed the problem the Black jobs crisis, and that term, you know, specifically refers to exactly what you were saying, you know, how it manifests today with, you know, folks not having equal access to work. You know, specifically since the pandemic started last March, nearly 85% of Black workers have applied for unemployment. So, you know, manifesting in that way and disproportionate rates of being unhoused and even, you know, I have to say, as I speak of the pandemic, obviously, you know, we're talking about COVID, but, you know, this is not our first time, you know, where Black folks have been disproportionately impacted by pandemics. We still are overrepresented in new rates of infection with HIV. And so, you know, just laying that out, and you have to put it in context to see, you know, where do that come from, right? The Black jobs crisis didn't, you know, just up and start recently. This is a long legacy, like, you know, just like Benny was saying earlier, this is 400 years, right? And I think this is so important of policy choices, right? And I'm not trying to reduce it all to just policy, but it's so important because that drives the culture. Remember when we used to see folks with the t-shirts that said legalize gay? You know, it was they were talking about gay marriage, but we know that was more like a cultural thing. It wasn't necessarily just about that. And so, you know, all of that to say, these were folks, these policy choices were made by folks who got together. They called a meeting. They sat down, they drafted, they wrote it out. They voted on it. They revised the draft. They voted again. You know, this is very, very intentional. And when I'm talking about these policies, I'm talking about policies like slavery, obviously, you know, to start. But even since then, you know, Jim Crow, separate but equal, Black codes, laws saying that Black folks are not allowed to read or write or own property or bear arms, which clearly some people think is debatable today, whether or not we allowed to bear arms, to assemble, to marry. Even, you know, I think about like the right to assemble, you know, what people are always defending, like, oh, it was a peaceful protest, or like loitering, you know, all of these, a lot of strong legacy. And of course, you know, with the Great Migration, a lot of Black folks in California came from down south, especially from like Texas, Louisiana, and they had, you know, laws for the Creole folks saying that you couldn't have your natural hair out. They had 10-year law said it was against the law for me to walk around looking like this. So, you know, just even, you know, taking those very small things into account that just devalue Black people, Black workers, all of our contribution. That's the legacy, you know, that we're working with. That is the culture that was dictated, like I said, by the policy going back hundreds of years. So it's only in that context that, you know, you could see folks making decisions that, you know, exclude Black workers, you know, and leave us out. I would also say that that is the, you know, the blueprint for perfecting other kinds of hate and exclusion. A lot of the violence, you know, against like our Asian siblings, and, you know, a lot of that is coming from, you know, we had. Now, I'm thinking about at the beginning of the pandemic, when they had the mask mandate, the mayor went on TV and said, because remember he was doing the nightly updates all the time, went on TV and said, okay, you know, we're doing a mask mandate. If you're going to be out and about, you need to have your nose and your mouth covered up. And if you need a mask, you can get them from people on the corner. And so in that moment, he basically admitted that the safety of his city lied with informal workers, who most of which had been excluded from his formal economy. So, you know, that there was never a moment that I saw that just made it so clear in the pandemic, you know, what was the role of essential, what was the role of Black workers, you know, in this city, and what is the value we have versus the value that we've been like assigned or given. I'm gonna move up, move back, but you know, this is some context in recent things that I've been looking at.
Thank you for that. Benny or Barbara, is there anything that you want to add to this question about factors that have contributed to the legacy of economic discrimination against Black folks in our community?
Thank you, Janelle. That was, I appreciated all of that. And along with the restrictions, as Janelle was saying, Black people from the beginning have been restricted from everything up until now to be able to breathe. They are now trying to take that away from us, just wipe us out. But one of the deeming factors here is the mobility, the ability to travel undisturbed, unharassed in this country, period. And even now, even in your own community, the ability to move around without being harassed, having police almost sometimes literally on every other corner. And then we talk about the ability to be able to seek employment, health, education, and recreation at your own desire, at your own needs. The ability to restrain you from going out after working hours. They understand, they have always accepted us as essential workers. That has not been our mindset. And they know this is not our mindset, which is why they even restrict our mobility when we are not even working. We have here in Los Angeles an apartheid transportation system. It's an apartheid system in the fact that it does it as over the past 5 years, we have been over 2 million service hours on the public transportation system has been removed. During the time of the Bus Riders Union consent decree with the MTA, we won over 1 million hours of service, along with a brand new 2,500 CNG buses. We had the rapid bus, the big red buses that took you from one point to another in about 30 minutes. You could go all the way from Union Station to Santa Monica, to the sea, actually, from downtown to the sea. And over the past years, they have taken that away. That was another thing that was won by the Bus Riders Union. And now, not only have they cut service, but now they are talking about this fareless transportation project that they want to start, which over the 25 years, the Bus Riders Union has been fighting for. Not equitable, because equitable could go either way. It could be the poorest. Everybody have the poorest, but we've been fighting for a first class transportation system. When we got into the Bus Riders Union was formed, MTA was moving, at that time they were RTD, but they were moving toward rail and choice riders to build a rail system. And by doing that, they were trying to get out of the bus system altogether. They no longer wanted to deal with the poor. They've always had a hatred for their low-income riders. And at that time, they were really trying to privatize the bus system. And of course, we fought against that. And since then, they have had this hatred for their bus, in particular their bus riders, but all of their riders. Now they are with the push that the Bus Riders Union has done. Thanks to COVID, they were forced to have a no fare bus system. And MTA admits itself that during the pandemic, their bus riders have continued to be faithful to the system, while the choice riders, which they created the rail for, has opted to go back to their cars because they've always had a choice. Now they're talking about, okay, let's look at a fareless bus system. But in order to have this, we're going to have a project. It's going to be an initiative first. Like COVID hasn't already been a project or an initiative to see what fareless transportation looks like. But in order to qualify, you're going to have to have a means test. Now, if you have already agreed that 70% of your riders are from low-income families. You've already admitted, and we all know that only 13%, the fare box recovery only is 13% of MTA's total budget, which means they really don't need it. Why do you need a means test? Why are you insulting your riders even more? Reflecting the animosity of what you feel for them when you are, what do you need a means test for? We already know who's riding the bus. And that, even with the means test, the poorest of the poor would not be able to qualify based on this means test. Why? We look at the ones that are currently returning home for incarceration, have no job. Those that do not get a paycheck but work daily cannot reflect their income. Those of the homeless population, which right now in Los Angeles, the Black people make up 50% of the homeless population. You have those that are differently able. They cannot even get either to a phone, either to a computer, or even go down in person to apply for this low means test. That's 5 different categories of people that are low income that would not qualify even if you had a means test. So really, what is the reason for the means test? So that you can say, oh, well, we had this project and the amount of people that applied for it was below our range. And you yourself decide what is low income, what is the high range, what is the low range. It's all on you. You have all the cards. So again, it's the attack on your Black and brown and low income writers. It is a way again for you to show the disinterest and the lack of will. This all comes down to a lack of will to provide a no fare, first class public transportation system here in Los Angeles. And this is, and we think about it, the US in general, Los Angeles specifically, claims to be one of the richest cities in the world, the richest country in the world. And yet there are 83 other countries, 83 other cities in the world that has a no fare public transportation system. So really, LA, really US, what is your problem? Why is it that we don't in 2021 have a no fare public transportation system? And lastly, every person, those poorest of the poor, still give to MTA 4.5 cents of every dollar for transportation.
Thank you. Benny, anything you want to add before we move on to the next question?
Sister Janelle said it very, very pointedly and on point that this is about policy. And this is the intersection of anti-Black racism, white supremacy, and capitalism leading and driving policy that excludes, leaves out, and discriminates. And this is the way it's played out. And if you look at Manuel Pastor's book, State of Resistance in California, it basically talks about how at one time California decision makers and the ruling economic class had to make decisions as to what was going to happen to white folks in California. Because you got to understand that people in the fields were white at one time. People that had menial jobs were people that came from the Midwest, right? And so they had to figure out, well, what's going to happen to their children? So that's when the state of California decided to invest in creating a world-class education system, at one time fully funded very well. But it was because it was intended for the children of these farm workers who were white. They wanted to create a middle class. So they created an industry, a defense industry in the South Bay, a auto industry in the Southeast that created good paying jobs. Now, that plan was somewhat challenged when, as Janelle said, the Black migration, the Great Migration came to California, to Los Angeles specifically, trying to get away from Jim Crow and police harassment, only to find out that they were met with the same kind of resistance, discrimination and practice, redlining, and similar types of policies here, because they were trying to create an economy that was going to service a white middle class and upper class population of young folks that had now received a good quality education, access to capital because of the GI Forum, we're going to be able to access and buy property and build a kind of an economic system that was going to favor this group. Now, when I think about economic development and its impact on South LA, specifically with Black folks, you got to think about job types, income, financial assets, and its relationship to quality of life issues, right? The stability of a community. So as Janelle said, and we have to learn from this, right? The economic middle class that was started and created by Black folks was done by Black folks along Central Avenue in the East Side. Racial covenants did not allow Black people to move west of Main Street for many, many years. So before people were in Leimert Park and Baldwin Hills and the Crenshaw Corridor, they were on the East Side, legally forced to stay on the East Side. So guess what? They created an economy out of the jazz industry that produced insurance companies, banks, hotels, music spots, right? Restaurants, an entire economy driven by and created by Black folks who were not getting access to other economic opportunities or allowed to buy homes or purchase real estate west of Main Street. That's an important segment because what it says is that in this current day and age, we got to continue to find ways to create and fund Black economies that are driven by and for Black people, you know, whether it's small businesses, commercial real estate, home ownership. These are the things that were critical in building somewhat of a Black middle class. The second thing was public sector jobs. You know, when Mayor Bradley got elected and people really pushed to change government systems, we start to see the creation of public sector jobs at the city and the county level that helped generate a stable, structured, middle-class Black community that still exists today, but is getting older and aging out in many communities. And that's affecting real estate because these folks were able to purchase a home. Maybe some of them were able to purchase a rental property. But with the current system being what it is, you're having a lot of people that are being challenged to sell their property. And so we're losing this housing that was Black-owned that took so much to build. That's very vulnerable. And that creates this vulnerability that then corporations take advantage of when they come into our communities and this issue of displacement kicks in. So public sector jobs, the private economy started by Black folks was critical. And then I think deindustrialization has been mentioned and that this, like the elimination of unions that protected workers who were Black, the descaling of salaries, low wage jobs, and then now the discrimination of Black employees by construction companies in this current reinvestment that hadn't taken place for 50, 60 years in South LA, that is now driving gentrification displacement. This redevelopment is excluding Black workers once again, as we've seen, which is what much of the Black Worker Center's work is all about, right? So we've seen that history has shown that policy has created opportunities on employment, on job types. It's affected incomes because you have now low wages. Everybody works in South LA in many capacities, but the wages are very low. We talk about, for example, we talk about Latino and immigrant workers specifically. You might have a household income where everybody works, but they're still making below poverty. And you have four or five people working. With Black folks, it's different in that there's discrimination and there's underemployment. And these kind of things are critical factors in establishing and stabilizing the Black community in terms of the economy and our communities in terms of quality of life, because the housing market is then forcing people who don't have now financial assets, because for the last 30 years, we've been undereducating Black and Brown folks. We don't have redlining like it once was or racial covenants like it once was, but what's the difference? If you don't have access to capital, what's the difference? You know, if you don't have programs that are subsidizing home ownership for Black folks, young couples, individuals, then and if you're driving the pricing housing market such that to buy a house in South Central, you have to pay $650,000. What does that mean for Black middle-class folks or professional folks who've gone to college and are coming back, looking to come back to the neighborhood, invest in their own community, and be part of the quality of life? We're losing Black culture. We're losing the Black safety net. We're losing these connections, these generational ties, and that's tied to financial assets. So if you don't have access to capital, you can't start a business. Some of our businesses that have been established in South LA that are Black owned have not been able to connect to the procurement pipeline that is part of the city and the county economy. So when we're talking about we're working on the ports, or we're working on the airport. Well, where is the pipeline to make sure that Black-owned businesses who hire Black workers who are based in South Los Angeles have access to that pipeline? See, so these are the things when you start looking at it. And then up until now, the PPP loans that came out of the federal government to support small businesses, to pay for salaries so they wouldn't have to lose employees. A lot of those loans did not get to our small and mid-sized businesses in South Los Angeles. So when you think about that, that impacts the financial assets, all of which is driven by policy and is played out by anti-Black racism, white supremacy, right? And this notion that capitalism is more important to sustain than the quality of life of Black and Brown people in South Los Angeles. So when you start to connect these pieces, like I said, there's lessons to be learned about the past, and more importantly, to change things about the future. Let's focus on building financial capacity of young entrepreneurs who want to create alternative forms of business development that is not about an extraction economy, but about an investment economy and about keeping our communities whole and bringing back folks who have had, who we've lost to the Inland Empire, to Palmdale, to Lancaster, because of the economic conditions being such, as well as the housing conditions being which. And so that's a long answer for a very specific question, but these questions are complex, brother, and I appreciate you asking them because I think it's important that we understand the intersectionality, that we can break these down collectively and specifically how it impacts Black people in South Philly. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you all done a great job of walking us through several decades, if not hundreds of years, of structural barriers. And just to take it back to a little bit of history in South LA, we know that once the manufacturing industries went to less unionized places, either other states or offshore, the public sector contracted and Black people were shut out of the growing service sector. Adding to this decline, we know that Black employment was greatly affected in the recession of 2007, which hurt Black and Latinx communities more than their white counterparts, right? Like that seems to be a repeating and recurring theme that it's, you know, it's always Black and brown folks when compared to white people who are faring less evenly. As we talked about in the previous episode, we touched upon housing and home ownership before the recession and how this contributed to a transfer of wealth from communities of color in South LA to equity firms. These combinations of events we know resulted in the displacement of South LA residents, primarily Black residents, in massive waves. Gentrification is now starting to hit South Los Angeles like we haven't seen before. And we know that qualified and educated Black candidates still face a lot of employment barriers and inequities in pay and advancement. So it all ties to the wealth gap. So what I would love for you all to touch upon is the current structural barriers to employment that Black and Latinx residents encounter in South Los Angeles. And Janelle, I'm going to ask you to take us off in this conversation, since I know this is what your organization primarily focuses on.
I would just have to, frankly, start with the obvious, like the clearest structure or barrier, you know, structural barrier that I see to, you know, folks' prosperity here is the police. Like our right to life is very publicly up for debate. And there's no chance I got at prospering if I'm not alive. We are doing a survey right now at the Black Worker Center. A bunch of leaders got together and designed a survey. They wanted to hear specifically from folks what their experience was with working. And the questions are really tailored to like employment and work and income. And there's a question on the back that just says, is there anything else you want us to know? Or what is one message that you really want to be out there? And a lot of people are opting to write in, stop shooting us. And police violence, you know, just all of that, the vulnerability that, you know, people have just going to and from work, looking from work, will I survive doing that? That is just the very obvious and outrageous question that a lot of Black workers have right now. So I think I would be remiss if I didn't start with that. I think so then too, another, you know, big barrier we looking at is just folks' inability to talk about it. And I mean, just bluntly address it. I can't tell you how many people I've had tell me straight up, oh, I can't say Black. You can't say what? You know, what does that even mean? Or folks, oh, I can't say Black, and then I'll hear them turn right on around and say Black and brown. Well, that's mighty interesting. Okay. Why are people saying that? Well, be blunt, some of them saying that because of racist, but a lot of people are saying it. I think you know, being genuine, they believe that it is against the law. They believe that there are legal structures that stop them from actually using the term Black or addressing, you know, from a place of equity, you know, some of the disparities with Black workers and Black people, particularly in the public sector. I think that they really, and this is what I was saying about policy driving culture, people saying this who ain't never read 209, okay, telling me, oh, the law says we can't say Black. Do it. But that's the culture of the workplace, right? That is the culture of the, you know, the machine that they're in. And so then, you know, having one, a way to address that so that people are clear about, you know, what equity mandate is or what that could look like, you know, what is this affirmative action? You know, it's kind of breaking that down for folks, like what is it and what is its practical application in our world? I think people being clear on that would be great. And I think also, you know, folks having a means to address discrimination when they see it or when they experience it. And so in the state of California, there is a statewide preemption on having local enforcement of laws that are, you know, against discrimination. And so, again, with that lack of clarity on, you know, how much, how far can local governments go in addressing discrimination, with that, you know, lack of extreme clarity, it then becomes a question of political will. And so it really can't be at the whim of, you know, the current leader, whether or not Black folks is going to live and or get to work and then stay there. You know what I'm saying? So that's, you know, kind of the situation at the moment. Like I said, it is at the political will. And I am, you know, really proud of, you know, establishing that the Civil and Human Rights Commission that's within the department at the city of Los Angeles. And that was, you know, for me, a really beautiful moment to observe. I'm from Chicago. And so to come to Los Angeles and see folks coming together around that, Black led, but all different people coming together because they understood that everyone would benefit together from that, really, truly was beautiful. There are human rights commissions in other major cities, you know, they got in New York, we got in Chicago. So to see LA, you know, really just build the leadership to say, this is something that's important to us. This is something that we want to do. We want to fund it. We're going to move it. Like that was, you know, just really awesome to see, you know, folks in our sphere here and, you know, within the organization, you know, really pick up and lead that. I think, like I said, there's a lot more work to be done in that area, but that's, like I said, some of the hugest structural barriers is, can we even name discrimination? Are we committed to addressing it? And my goodness, are the people going to live to see it? You know, that's the biggest structural barriers.
Thank you for that. Benny, I'm going to ask you a follow-up question to something that you touched upon earlier, and that is education and class status. You talked about how for a time period, Black folks were able to establish a middle class and Central Avenue was booming. But I'd love for you to talk about how education and class status grant economic advancement to residents in South LA, and what challenges and barriers do residents face when our young people in particular are not given the full benefit of having an education, which then limits, you know, the opportunities that they have later on in life to access meaningful employment and, you know, quality of life.
I'd say that you'd have to look at this once again historically. And so, you know, you have to look at Prop 13 and the impact that had on funding school, you know, local schools. And that really, when you think about the deterioration of the education of our Black and Brown communities, I remember the day that we had a field trip maybe every 2 weeks. We had a music teacher come in. We had an arts teacher come in. We had special programming after school. I remember when that stopped, you know, and that was a result of policymakers driving this policy that said we no longer want to invest in schools because our white children have left the schools. Why are we going to invest in schools if we have now, our people, our children have now graduated and are starting businesses? Now we're investing in Black and Brown communities. And in this case, around that time, we talk about Asian refugees, right, coming in and other populations, the beginnings of Central American folks coming in. So as these schools begin to look Black and Brown, and Asian, and the need to invest was very different. And so that's the first thing I would identify. So now we're looking now 20, 30 years as a result of that legacy, and you think we have generated a class of educated folks that have a very big gap in terms of basic skills, competitive knowledge sets in terms of going to college. And even those that don't go to college, we used to have programs that provided some training when it was connected to these good paying jobs in the manufacturing sector, et cetera. Those got outdated and outlived. And so the education system has a direct relationship and impact to the preparation of people to not only be potentially workers, man, but to be civically engaged individuals. We need leaders. We don't just need people to put their head down and grind. We need people to put their head up and understand the relationship to the larger economic well-being of a community. And education is an important part of that piece. When you think about the fact that, for example, when you look at immigrant youth born here, like first generation children currently of immigrant parents that came within the last 20 years to the United States, there is a projection that economically speaking, those children will be financially worse off than their immigrant parents. Now, in the history of America's migration of Latinos or people that come from, you know, the Americas, we've never seen that before. The children of immigrants have always done better than their parents, economically speaking. This might be the first generation where that is different. And that being because people are not being educated in a way that's going to be important to the kind of high wage and strong infrastructure jobs that we need for our young people to be a contributing factor of their community economically and civically because of the preparation that they're getting or not getting in schools. Look, you've been a part of this, Elmer, through your work at Community Coalition. You all have fought to bring more dollars to South Philly schools, and you and other partners. But it's not just about the investment of dollars. It's also how are we preparing our parents to engage with schools that don't want them there? If they don't love their children, how are they going to love their parents, right? There's this whole movement by groups like Cadre and other people who've been working on this, on school climate reform. I know that Bus Riders Union worked on this as well, right? The idea that our children should be valued assets in our district and they should be educated in that manner. As opposed to seen as children with deficiencies, children that are not being invested in. So this is something that's super important that we need to understand that the relationship and this whole notion that we're gonna just generate these high wage jobs and that these industries are gonna open the doors to our children is something that also needs to be closely analyzed and looked at, because we haven't seen that happen in South LA in the last couple of decades. And while there's a need to invest in careers like green and tech and things of that nature, we also have to make sure that the schools are producing the ability of young people to engage with that. And that requires more investment, deeper investment, better relationships between community-based organizations and these schools, these industries actually investing money in preparing the labor force, right? Just like the state of California invested in building the capacity of white folks to create good middle-class jobs and engineers and aerospace folks. And they have to make that same investment with our community. It's an issue of political will, and it's an issue of policy. And it's really, the last thing I'll say is that, what are the consequences, Elmer? What are the consequences to people in political power when our children are not being educated? What are the consequences? Do they get let go? So we have to step up our game too in the community and hold people more accountable and develop a collective vision for what we feel is needed, especially those of us that focus on economic development, because we know the gap, we know the difference, we know how people are living, we know what education, the difference education makes, whether it's college education or good, strong high school education, and then the training needs that people can use to bridge the gap between where they're prepared in high school and the industry needs to go forward.
Absolutely. Instability at the top is also a huge issue, especially for LA Unified. Asta Buettner just announced his departure as his role of superintendent. It'll be the sixth superintendent leaving in 10 years in LA Unified. And we know that that creates a lot of challenges, because with each new leader, you bring in new ideas, new politics, new policies. And so there's the inertia LAUSD continues to turn with each time that a new leader steps to the helm. We know it's a very difficult job, especially having to deal with a school board that is very politicized. But at the end of the day, our students and our families are the ones that bear the brunt of all of these changes. So thank you for all of that, Benny. So Barbara, I'm going to ask you to talk to us about what is happening today and how COVID-19 and the pandemic have exacerbated inequities in Black employment, Brown employment, and in particular in South Los Angeles, how you've seen this just devastating time period put further pressure on our folks here in the community.
Well, it wouldn't be right if I did not make this statement. The Americas went down and started downhill in 1492. Can we go back and reverse October 1492? Once here, of course, we know the devastation that happened. And then I'm going to move fast forward from 1492, the murder of hundreds of nations within this land. And the thing that strikes us now is when we look at the freedom of the Black nation, supposedly freedom of the Black nation, immediately after the emancipation, they created the police. The police has continued to do what they were created to do way back then. We talk about education, the lack of education, and now we have to speak of the police. How do we go from educating our students to incarcerating our students while they are supposed to be in an educational building? How could we have such an example of Cleveland High School that had a police station inside of its school? How do we move from that? How do we move from the police as a big part of segregation? We saw it captured on TV for us when Black people were fighting for their civil liberties, civil rights, and you have police and dogs attacking them. Why is that keep coming up? Police. And even in transportation, we are police on public transportation, really, really, which is why we're calling for no police on public transportation. It's always, and Janelle started with, you cannot erase the fact that police has been a thorn and they're the greatest catalyst for the racist and imperialistic society that we live in to control the people that they don't want here, or to control the people that are essential workers to ensure that they remain there. COVID, oof, how devastating it is. And you want to talk about COVID. We have people that are so afraid of police long before COVID that they did not want to leave their homes. How you have a neighborhood where you can't walk from to the corner without seeing a cop? How many neighborhoods that we have other than the Black and Brown that you fear just the fact of seeing a cop, you wonder, is this going to be the day for me? Is this going to be my last day? And now you have with the COVID, which has cut down the ability for even some of our essential workers to even get to work, to even keep their jobs, is another issue. We have for what COVID has brought, you have the Ralph's supermarket that is now refusing to pay the $5 extra for its essential workers. So they rather close the store. In the area that I live, because I am in South Central LA on the corner of King and Crenshaw. So I have the Ralph's, it's right down the street from me, that's closing. not to mention the wholesale part of Ralph's, can't think of the name of it right now, that's on Western in Slauson that is now closing. Those are three major food industries in South Central LA alone that is being closed due to COVID. We have others, a friend of mine who's working in the hospital as an essential worker. As much as we need them, they're cutting the staff there as well. How are people supposed to stay healthy when they are doubling their time, which causes them to be less with their families? This has brought down an insecurity, a feeling of safety to our people. And the essential workers, the Black and Brown communities, are the ones that's being affected the most. A, because they cannot work. Some of them cannot work. And then the others are overworked. And how do we eliminate this? How do we eliminate? How do you have you are an essential worker. You've got to get to work. But the majority of people are riding public transportation. They are, first of all, they're afraid to get on public transportation. Do the people there, are we covered? Do they wear their masks? Or is there going to be a cop on the bus that's now going to ask me for ID? Or a cop on the bus that's going to intimidate me just by standing over me? Just the fact of standing over me. And why are you standing over me? The COVID has brought the height then of moving on toward the hatred of other people, in particular people of Asian descent that has come here. Why is it that this has filtered and festered our communities? It has not brought us closer together, which you would think it would. It has separated us. The fact that some families haven't even seen family members since, it is now a year, and some family members have not even seen their loved ones because of COVID. Or those of us that are in like convalescent homes, you cannot visit them. Even when I had to go to the doctor to receive a test, I had to first get a COVID test before I could even go to the hospital to get the procedure. And now they are threatening and suggesting that when the city reopens and we want to travel, here again, our mobility, that we have to now possibly have a card that shows that we have had our two vaccinations in order to travel. And in the Black community, we have a historical fear of testing on us. We have never been able to trust the system to have our best interests at hand. And what has this done and affected our cities? So again, it's a sad situation. And is this COVID and everything that we're, and that's the other thing with COVID, it makes us question even the information that we're being given. You know, Johnson & Johnson has been a household word for so many years. And now they're in question because they are promoting the vaccine. But I just heard today, though it's not really being used here in the U.S., it's going to be used abroad, which is the thing that has always happened with regard to health and aid to other countries. We always send to them things that have been rejected in this country. Don't get the FDA approval here, but we can send it abroad as if those are not people. And why is that we are not respecting the mortality of others as well as we're respecting those here in this country? And so I do not think that we will ever get back to the norm. And honestly, when I think about it, I don't want to get back to the norm. the police brutality that is widespread here in this country. I don't want to go back. So when we say go back to Nam, I think of it as the same as someone whose name I will not say is Make America Great Again. What exactly does that mean? And how do we move forward? Hope that answers the question.
Thank you, it does. I
just wanted to point something out that Barbara mentioned. She talked about the store closure, and you know, Janelle's identifying that that is retaliation for Black people wanting what's fair. And I think that when we look at the history of good food access in our communities tied to jobs and employment in union protected jobs, that's been a very, that's part of the, you know, de-escalation of employer protections, of good paying jobs, of union jobs, that it's like the last of what's left in our communities. But I say, you know, we should figure out this goes back to the political will. How do we take over a supermarket like that? Let's make it a work owner cooperative. Let's reimagine what that market could be for Black folks, right? Workers as well as residents, in bringing healthy quality foods, but creating different economic models that could be sustained for our communities and by our community. I mean, I think this is where the political will bring in the banking industry. Let's get capital in there to figure out how to do something different. Let's look at work owner cooperatives model and figure out, can we do something like that? Because work owner cooperatives exist all over the Bay Area, in Black communities, in brown communities, and they seem to be a critical part of the economic infrastructure. So why not bring that to that supermarket? Okay, you don't want to pay $5 extra to Black and brown workers for what, because of, you know, profit over people, then let's, you lose your right to run a business in our community, so you lose the ability to have this physical space. That's the kind of political will that people have done, policy-wise. People have done that before, not for our interests, but for other interests. So why not do it in this situation? Just an example of how we can look at economic opportunities tied to changing the conditions and relationship between corporations, industries, and our community.
Thank you, Benny, for that. And just to touch briefly on that, you know, the Crenshaw District is now has created a coalition, and they are trying now to buy the Crenshaw Mall to keep it Black, to keep it a mall and not a high-rise condo plaza, which they are currently trying to do. So a co-op is a great thing. And we go back to the fiduciary system here in the country, as you were talking about, even getting a support from financial institutions to support the co-op that they're trying to create. It's, again, one step forward. They try and push us 3 or 4 steps backwards. And that is the political system that we're under.
Thank you for that. I want us to move on to the next and final section of this conversation, which has been really wholesome. And I want us to talk about opportunities for collaboration between Black and Latino residents, starting first by talking about the obvious that, you know, Latinos have had better access to employment, although for the most part, you know, our community has been confined to low paying and insecure jobs that still keep folks in poverty. The economic restructuring that kept the Black community highly unemployed is the same that condemns Latino immigrants to low wage, dead end jobs. Structural racism persists even when some of the discriminatory practices are no longer legal. Thus, there is more work to be done, such as organizing to ensure that access to employment opportunities for Black and brown residents, become more available for South LA. And I want to ask Benny to touch on this, because I think this is it's an important that we need to talk about, and that is anti-Blackness in the Latino community and the way that our folks are seduced by the promise that America gives us that if we only behave better than Black people, we will be accepted into the American culture. And as we all know, time and time again, that is, it's not true. It's just a lie that we continue to be, that we give into. And time again, we are reminded that, our well-being and freedom really lies on us building unity with our Black brothers and sisters to fight for better than what is being offered to us. So I'd love for you to talk about multiracial organizing and how it can help combat barriers for Black and Brown folks overall, but importantly, more importantly, when it comes to economic opportunities.
Yeah, thank you for that, Elmer. Well, I think you start off by saying what is true is that there is a lot of anti-Black racism that exists in the Latino community because of how it's fed to us, right? How we see it in the media, how the narratives of Black folks are never interpreted into language that our community, the immigrant community, can understand, how employers basically, use these as wedge issues between workers, right? There's also a kind of a narrative that's developed that says, that Latinos, even though there's a large population of them in a certain community, don't have any real power or representation. The media builds off the tension because it sells newspapers, it sells ads, it sells TV time. So there is a lot that needs to be done to really understand where that mentality comes from, how it's counterproductive, how it doesn't help us advance the quality of life of Latinos, period. As you mentioned, the future of Latinos is intertwined with the betterment of the Black communities' opportunities to have good economic opportunity. Like, we all have to work together to rise together. I mean, I think that's the way we see it. But more has to be done, Elmer. And I think that there is a very disempowered immigrant population. So they tend to connect with each other, and they tend to have an analysis that's driven by individual experiences instead of understanding collective data-driven experiences in South Los Angeles. I think that when I've seen institutions, they've been the biggest culprits. When I used to work in Watts, and I would see the way school administrators manipulated Black and Brown parents against each other to move them away from looking at what was going on in the schools itself and the quality of education and the treatment of both Black and Brown children, right? So I've seen how institutions play that out. But, I think that we need to build progressive Latino leadership, conscious leadership that understands the relationship and the interconnection to the struggle of Black folks to be free, the history and the legacy of Black folks and what they've done in South Central Los Angeles to create opportunities. And we also have to create a critical population's critical analysis to challenge institutions that discriminate towards Black folks and create moments and movements of solidarity. I think that's what's really missing now with young folks, because we now have two or three generations of Black and Brown children who've grown up together. They seem to understand this a lot better. So when we talk about multiracial organizing, we do it with high school folks all the time. What I see that doesn't happen enough, Elmer, is we don't try and organize Black and Brown adults to work together or to focus on building Black leadership, sometimes together, sometimes independent. Same thing with Latinos. I always think about Larry Aubrey, who was one of my mentors, and he passed away, right, I think it was right before COVID, or right when COVID started. And he would always tell me, Benny, I'm all about multicultural organizing, but us Black folks got to get our stuff together, and then we could come and talk to y'all. And I was like, I respect that. I understand that. And I think when you look at the narrative of having to challenge white supremacy and policy and systems, anti-Black racism, and the need for systems reform, we need to understand how we work together. What is our collective vision that understands not only the history and the legacy of anti-Black racism, but also how do we work together in thriving, economically solid communities, right? That allows for spaces, I keep saying this, that brings back Black folks who have been pushed out of South LA and creates opportunities for Latinos who are here to also feel integrated in the civic infrastructure of South Los Angeles. Because I think Latinos probably would say that they don't see themselves in any positions of leadership, even though they see themselves living on the block and moving in. And we see the east side of South Los Angeles looking very different than the west side of South Los Angeles. I still think that people feel a sense of disempowerment. And so the reaction cannot be a very nationalist agenda that is all about Latinos. It can't be about that. It has to be about how do we create critical thinking, progressive leadership in the Latino community where there's that population that then can show and set an example for other Latinos to understand the relationship and the need to do the multiracial organizing and the leadership development and the power building that is needed to hold anybody in political office accountable to meet the needs of working class people in South LA. I mean, I think that there's this misnomer that we don't need to continue to invest in Black leadership because we have elected officials who are Black. That couldn't be further from the truth. I think we need to invest even more in Black leadership because when we look at nonprofits, when we look at the private sector, when we look at public office, we don't see Black folks seeing themselves there either. So I think this is part of the overall multicultural work that has to happen where we are looking at how to create an equitable community that understands that analysis, Elmer, and works from that analysis and then works through what does that look like for Black folks, for brown folks, and also for immigrants, because not all immigrants are identified or see themselves as of Latin origin, right? We have many immigrants in South LA who identify as African-American or as Black identified. And that's an important thing to also, that is missing. So when you talk, going back to the issue of anti-Black racism as it's perceived by Latinos, sometimes they don't understand the diaspora and the whole concept of Afro-Latino is sometimes lost because it's considered more of an East Coast thing as opposed to a West Coast phenomenon. But when you go to Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, Belize, if you look at the Caribbean side of the region, right? You go to Colombia, Panama, the Caribbean side of the continent's population looks very different from the Western side of the population. And so it's important that we understand and grapple with this, man. But it goes back to education, Elmer. Our schools don't talk about this. We don't talk about this in our education system. Our youth programming that happens, are we talking about this? Is our organizing focused around this? I mean, these are the things that we need to continue to understand the regional as well as the kind of localized impacts of migration, of disinvestment, of displacement of people. And I think when we start doing that, we get to a better place. And I appreciate all the organizations that have been putting in work specifically since 1992 in South LA, as we talk about in the report, right? That we've grown organizationally in South LA. We've come to a better place politically in terms of our analysis. But unfortunately, man, we're not moving the economic needle for Black and brown folks and immigrants in South LA the way at a ratio that reflects the great policy that's been created. Like, it's just not trickling down, Elmer. And I think that's a multicultural organizing dilemma that we have to continue to figure out.
That's right. We wouldn't have reggaeton if it wasn't for Afro-Latinos. Have you join the conversation. I'd love for you to talk about campaigns or efforts advocating for equitable access to employment.
Awesome. Yeah. And big facts. I'm a big reggaeton fan too. So yes. Shout out to all our folks for making that happen.
That's right.
Yes. So in the city, I'm really excited about this. I was a part of our work on 1,000 Strong, which is an effort to get 1,000 jobs connected for Black folks. As a part of that, we're doing a demonstration project with the city. And so we will see how do we create pathways, you know, into public sector jobs. And this is really, you know, been a long time, you know, a lot of hands on deck for this. Just envision that, you know, how do we come back from even the last recession? How do we bring back jobs that were outsourced, jobs that were not only outsourced, but, you know, privatized in such a way that even sometimes might be using free stolen labor, right? You know, how do we bring back, you know, good union jobs and, you know, get folks into the city? So, yeah, we're doing what I hope will later become a small demonstration project. You know, when you consider the scale of what this could be and make a clear, like I said, equitable path for folks to, you know, get in with the city, you know, historically Black public sector jobs. I'm excited about collaborating with more folks on that.
Excellent. Thank you. And Barbara, what about you? Opportunities for South LA residents to promote community and generational wealth and health.
Well, I first wanted to back up a minute and just make one real significant point about COVID and the effect that it has had. And I don't know where my mind was when I was talking earlier, but COVID has had a real heavy impact on organizations like all of ours to get out and organize people within the community. And we are, I can fairly say that now after a year, we are slowly reopening our doors and taking, and the vaccine is out there and I finally took mine. I was one of those apprehensive about taking it, but I just wanted to put that out, in fact, that it has hindered our ability to organize because we organize the public. We're on the bus stops and there's nobody there. So the ability to even go and have a community meeting and be able to have a significant amount of people in a social distance space is something that we are working toward and reinventing for ourselves. We just started for the past month, opened up our doors for a once a week on Saturdays, and we're calling it our political block party that we do every Saturday to bring the people back out, let them know that we are here, that we're here and we are here. Our doors are open and we are reaching out to people to really help us in our fight. And so, yeah, I just wanted to start by that. And after saying all that, I forgot what you asked me. What?
If you can share opportunities for South LA residents to promote community and generational wealth and health.
Oh, yes. Well, you know, as I said in the beginning, the strategy center's strategy is to build a united front with Black and Latinos to fight the imperialist racist country that we in with a very heavy accent on the third world. So we have always been a multiracial, multi-generational organization from its roots, because we see that we agree that it takes a village to raise a child, and in that village is all generations. That's why it's a village. And we do not believe that we can do it any other way. We realize that the majority of the issues that we have from one another is based, going back to what Janelle said, on policies. The things that we hear and the systemic racism that everyone coming to this country is indoctrinated with before they even get here. They have a false assumption of what is here, and particularly a false assumption of what Black people are before they even get to this country. So we have to go back and wash all of that away. And then we need more communities building to accept the fact that the communities will probably no longer be of one nation. It's almost, I don't even see that possibility now because of the, thank God, we do believe in open borders. So it's fulfilling our understanding that it is gonna take the Black United Front, Black and Brown United Front, to change We're talking about the new norm. The new norm we want is a true Black and united front against the racism that is this country. And we are working very hard on that.
So, Omar, to answer that question.
Yes, please.
Listen, brother, what are we all here on this call? We are all from the nonprofit sector. The nonprofit sector is the fourth largest economy in the state of California. Its leadership is white and aging out. There is a movement at the city and county level and even at the state because of the Black Lives Matter movement and other reform movements to look at anti-Black racism institutionally, to invest in Black-led, Black-serving nonprofits, to look at other areas where marginalization exists and invest in those communities. So who does that work? Who does the social service work? Who does the direct action organizing work? Who does the advocacy work? Who does the self-help programming? It's nonprofits. So nonprofits need to invest in their own community, hire locally, invest in Black and Brown leadership development so that they can become their outreach workers, so they can engage our residents better. So what we're doing with the Promise Zone designation, which is known as Slate Z, in these next 12 months, we're developing an apprenticeship program that's going to get 100 participants from the 8th, 9th, and 10th Council District to be placed as small nonprofits so that they can help rebuild and strengthen the safety net that's now destroyed because of COVID, and build the small nonprofits' capacity to then engage in contracts and grants with these bigger nonprofits that service our community, that have better access to the government, to the philanthropic center. So we're doing that to not only build the professional development and entry-level skills that young people need in the nonprofit sector, we're strengthening the nonprofit sector's capacity to see themselves as employers, as an integral part of our community's social safety net. And we're developing career pathways in which skills can resonate and connect to public sector jobs, government jobs, and obviously the nonprofit career opportunities. So we think that investing in the nonprofit sector is a critical part of building that Black leadership, that foundations all of a sudden have woken up and decided they really want to invest money into, well, let's create the pipeline of future leaders in these nonprofits by strengthening and investing in them. So fortunately, because of demands from the community that dollars be invested in South Los Angeles, the 8th, 9th, and 10th council members, Councilmember Price, Councilmember Marquis Harris Dawson, and Councilmember Mark Willie Thomas, are taking some of their dollars of the Defund the Police, Reimagine Public Safety dollars and investing them in the Slate Z Promise Zone to create this apprenticeship program. And hopefully it's not a one-time thing, but the creation of something, as Janelle's saying, that builds infrastructure, that provides long-term opportunities to really transform our communities by really investing in young folks. As I mentioned earlier, we don't just want workers, we want civic leaders who understand that their employment is directly tied to the transformation economically of our neighborhoods and our communities. And so in that, an apprenticeship program, just like we professionalize people for construction jobs and other types of jobs, that investment also needs to be made in the nonprofit sector. So we're excited about putting that together. And we're hoping that that becomes a blueprint that maybe other industry sectors can utilize, Elmer, and that we continue to get more investment in the long haul so that we can really help transform South Los Angeles by investing in its own residents. So that's a long-term, a short-term example of what could have long-term impact in our communities economically. To begin to move away from this issue of concentrated poverty and generational income inequality that we see happening, you know. I think that this is a perfect opportunity. If we don't act, we're going to see the semblance of 2008. We're going to see what happened with Katrina in South LA. So, you know, the COVID, disproportionate impact of COVID, the movement on the ground for Black lives and identifying historic systemic injustice, and these new elected officials that got elected, right? They're seem eager, and the political will might be there. So let's force these three elements to really develop the kind of policy investments and programs that we need, especially as these dollars, right, Elmer, come from the feds, you know, the $1.9 billion that are coming to the county and the $1.3 billion that are coming to the city. How we invest those is our opportunity to be equitable. Let's put some power behind that term equity that everybody seems to like to throw around. Let's put some real financial investments. Let's get some data to see the impact and track it. And let's see what a difference it can make in our community when we look at it from that perspective and we make those kinds of investments that are needed. So just wanted to put that out there.
So we're going to get ready to close out, and I'm going to invite each and every one of you to help us close out and give us any recommendations for our listeners that they should pay close attention to or take action around. If there are any policies around economic advancement that, you know, are either active right now or queued up that, you know, may need community backing in order for them to come to fruition, especially for residents in South Los Angeles. I know you all have thrown around some great nuggets and ideas. What do you recommend that our listeners walk away with that they should Google right away or contact someone right away and plug into those efforts? And I'm going to start with Janelle. Why don't you kick us off and give us your closing recommendations for action?
I'm excited because I have so many. So I think, you know, one of the things that is going to be super important, if they can go on our website, LABlackWorkerCenter.org, or look on our Facebook or Instagram, maybe our Twitter, but fill out your survey. So the survey that the Political Education Committee put together is going to be used to dictate, you know, figure out what our program is going to look like moving forward. So we really want to hear from folks, you know, very specifically what you're going through, what you want to see change, what do we need to get together around? So please do that survey and share it with folks. And I would say keep an eye out as well for, you know, 1,000 strong and, you know, making a movement with the Department of Public Works. There are often public meetings where it's very helpful to have folks sharing their stories with our city council folks. So that'll be, you know, another thing to be on the lookout for. One thing that came to mind as I was listening to you speak earlier, Benny, both about police and like relationships between our communities, I think it's so important that everybody really truly understand that we, the people, like us, our civilians, right? We really truly are all we got. And in the liberated world that we seek, the relationships we have with each other are going to be so important. We will call on each other to support each other. And so, at the very least, know your neighbors and be, you know, in some relationship with them. It's important. We have a lot of, I think, especially maybe people who listen to podcasts and are in the nonprofit stuff, we get, you know, in our heads sometimes and we have our stated values and we know what to say about the policies, but we are imperfect people and we learn to walk this walk every day. And so part of us living our values is just being real and knowing who's around us and how we show up for folks like we got each other's back. You know, I think all the time about, there was a time I was much younger and I didn't even think about it. The police had their hands on somebody and it was obvious that they was gonna get hurt. And I grabbed the cop's arm. Okay, yeah, that was probably real dangerous and wacky of me, but it was just what I thought to do, right? And it was a time where we didn't have all camera phones. So you wouldn't just record it, you would do something, you know? And so I think, you know, that kind of mindset of how we show up for each other. Do you got my back? You gonna stop me from getting harmed? You know, that level of relationship and care. I hope that everybody can think each day how we can show up for each other.
I would say there's three things, Elmer, tied to that. So one is kind of one of the things that's been really effective is when organizational leaders, and I know Janelle and Barbara have been a part of these kind of conversations, where we coalesce around the impact of COVID, the impact of police violence, right, or historic inequality, making sure that organizational leaders and not just the organizational leaders, but members of the organization are being part of these conversations. We need to pass on this knowledge, because as some of us get older and maybe retire or move on to something different, we want to make sure that that next generation of leadership has already established those relationships, as Janelle's saying, and it's really tied to building an understanding, a collective consciousness and awareness and solidarity. I think that's super, super important, because if the organizers get together with service providers that get this, we can then move masses, because elected officials would need to work with us as opposed to divide us and separate us. So one thing is that. Second thing is, we have a mayoral election in 2022. We need to start engaging civically with our residents to help shape the agenda and the policy discussions that are going to then move candidates to make decisions and create platforms that then we can hold them accountable to, whoever gets elected, right? So I think it's important that we understand that civic elections are coming up in 2022. And so how are you organizing your block club? How are you working with your faith-based organization? How are you working with your nonprofit service provider or your traditional community organizing groups, or even your, well, unions are always kind of on that, but, you know, like Janelle said, the civic, the grassroots resident, how are you connecting with this? And then the third thing is, I think everybody should be watching the, you talked about financial investments once again, Elmer, money that's coming from the feds, this 1.9, is it going to go to doing things different, or is it going to go to just backfilling budgets that keep things status quo, right? There's $1.3 billion that are coming to the city. Is it going to support kind of the demands that have been generated by Brotherhood Crusade, Inner City Struggle, COCO, and SEIU's kind of demand that these monies go to make our city whole and target those most marginalized, and all the organizations support it and support that call and the people's budget? Like, is that money going to go towards that? Or is it going to go to status quo opportunities to just go back to bureaucracies that don't many times service our communities most needed? And then the last thing I'll say is, a new model that might be important for us to look at is this movement towards a universal income. So Councilmember Price is doing that, super excited. He's investing $6 million of his Defund the Police, Reimagine Public Safety dollars into his district. I know Maurice Harris-Dawson is doing the same thing now. I don't know how much money, but he's doing something similar. And I think this might be the new way to look at creating a model that addresses many times the gap that people have, where they have to make choices between going to work and childcare costs, or feeding them, your children, something healthy, or buying what you just need, the fast food, because you can't afford it. I mean, a universal income model that would be tremendously impactful and could be really transformative. And if it works, can be something that we can expand and look at as a new strategy and tool, or to address this issue of concentrated poverty in our South LA community. So I would say those are the things that I would call out for folks, both nonprofit leaders, nonprofit workers, but also community-based organizations, also grassroots residents, to keep an eye out and be aware of, so that we can hold all of us accountable to make sure we move that economic needle for Black folks, for Brown folks, and for immigrants in South LA.
Thank you. And Barbara, you have the final word.
Wow. Whew. This, you know what, this has been, I have really enjoyed this conversation. I think that we brought a lot of sincerity to the table, and I hope that it continues. One of the greatest things that we can do for each other, and we spoke briefly on it, but is the true collaboration of each one of us, though our mainframe may be mainframe may be different, it is focusing on the same thing. And we need to really and genuinely support each other better. I think that one of the things, especially after COVID, is We God, I just lost my thought. But it is the fact of really supporting each other. You know, not it's more to support than a sign or letter. You know, it's got to, we can do better than that. We can do better than that. And even coming out to an event, we can do better than that. I think it is really truly time that we have a true joint venture. Something that we come together and really do. This is going out. What I'm saying, when this is in for a joint venture. You're having something. We're coming out and we're pulling out all of the stops for you. This is about you at this time, and to do that with all sincerity. Secondly, we must keep up the vigilance of organizing our communities. It's hard, but I feel that we're needed even more now. And we must, and in that, just a little tad bit of, because the verdict yesterday was good, but that's just the tip of the iceberg. We cannot let our communities falter and accept that as the prize. That wasn't the prize. We have not gotten there at all. And we need to do more work in order to get to the prize. And it is policy change and the systematic changing of the systemic racism that is this country. And not, as Janelle was saying, not to be able to say the word Black. It's a Black issue, it's a brown issue. Just say it, and it's not, we don't want to fall into those people. I think we've all heard that those words should never come to our mouths. We should be proud and improving in the work we do and be able to call it what it is. The third thing I would like to just mention is, you know, the strategy center and the Bus Riders Union is in a fight now to get police off of public transportation. And we talk about the harmfulness and necessity to remove them from the public transportation system. We were able, with the collaboration just of community organizations, to reduce the LAUSD police by $35 million. Now, yes, but we haven't gotten them the budget completely removed, but that's a good start. And now we're fighting to ensure that the 35 mil is absolutely 100% given to the 53 most needed schools and the ones with the largest population of Black students. And to ensure that we're fighting, it's not insured yet, we're fighting with LAUSD to not have those police officers that are no longer in the schools as police officers become the mediators, or the what's that other term they use for transformative? No, that's not our term. I can't think of the name of it now. But they should not become the counselors. They are there of the students, and they should not be there at all. They should not be there at all. And we are fighting now with the school to ensure that, because their mentality is still police. They're going to take everything that they learned back into the job. And that's what we don't want. So thank you.
Well, those dollars are supposed to be reinvested in Black folks and in schools that service young Black folks, right? That's where those dollars are supposed to go.
Right. And you know why it's calling for peer mediation and restorative justice practices. The police believe that they can do that. And they are calling on their jobs, and the fact that the LAUSD thought that was okay. That they thought that was okay to use these same people. Police has been criminalizing our students to be there as mentors. I mean, that's, you know, what it reminds me of is in the 40s, 50s, and even in the 60s, when teachers would tell Black students that, you know, I think it would be best if you get a trade. You know, I don't think college is the right thing for you. Really? And then you're going to have a police officer try to mentor our students? It's that same mentality.
Well, Janelle, Benny, and Barbara, I want to thank you all for your time, for sharing your wisdom, and sharing powerful tips for the ways that our listeners and our community can get involved in improving the economic conditions for folks in our community. I thank you for your work and your commitment to the movement and for your dedication to making sure that we have more opportunities for folks to live more meaningful and fruitful lives and receiving the compensation that they deserve for their hard labor. So thank you all for joining us on yet another exciting and wonderful podcast. We thank you for your time and for participating. And we hope you all remain well and safe and take care of your loved ones and take care of yourself. Have a wonderful afternoon.
Thank you.
This podcast is made possible by the generous investments of the California Endowment. The content is taken from the South LA Rooted Report, which is written by Laura Murata and Eric Watt in collaboration with Special Service for Groups Incorporated.
The show is produced at the Hood Digest Digilab. It's narrated by Marlo J. and Elmer Roldan. The theme music features original content from South Central Cartel's South Central Madness and original music produced by Rico Pavon. The podcast is produced by Daniel Castillo and Brian Aguilar. Our assistant producer is Nelly Arciniega.
Subscribe, share, comment, and like the South LA Rooted podcast on all platforms.